All right, the first British utilitarian, Jeremy Bentham, who lived from 1748 to 1832. Bentham was the son of a wealthy attorney. He studied Latin when he was 3 years old. Graduated from Oxford when he was 15 years old. He went and studied law. He never practiced law. He wrote on legal theory. In terms of British culture, you should know that he was the founder of the Westminster Review in the year 1824. He wrote The Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, 1789. And based on it, developed an elaborate scheme for prison reform in England. Bentham was the leader of a reform group that called themselves the Philosophical Radicals. Bentham advocated the view that a legislator's guiding aim should be the principle of, quote, general utility, and that only. That is, the legislator should consider the general utility of legislation, its usefulness, and that's all you should consider. Is the secular mindset evident immediately here? No abstract theories, not a question of eternal verities or rights, no divine revelation, none of that gobbledygook of the philosophers and theologians. The usefulness of a piece of legislation is the only thing that counts. According to Bentham, moral good is such, quote, only on account of its tendency to secure physical benefits. Moral good is such only on account of its tendency to secure physical benefits. And he said that the principle of utility takes as its starting point in all reasoning, quote, the calculus or comparative estimate of pains and pleasures. I want you to get that quote because that, in a sense, typifies this mentality. The calculus or comparative estimate of pains and pleasures. You look at physical benefit, pains and pleasures, what's physical, and you do a calculus on it. And I'll give it to you even better, another quote. He said, we must discover some calculus or process of moral arithmetic by which we may arrive at uniform results. You know, my flesh is crawling here as a philosopher now. Moral arithmetic. That's his expression. You might think that's what I might say, you know, to, in a sense, give a characterization to put it down. But that's what he said. We do moral arithmetic. Quote, legislation may thus become a mere matter of arithmetic, he said. A mere matter of arithmetic. His utilitarianism has often been called the greatest happiness principle. The greatest happiness principle. Our moral decisions and our legislation should be based on the principle that we seek the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Bentham is the founder of the utilitarian outlook, but it was a follower of him who more thoroughly developed this outlook, John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 1873. John Stuart Mill enjoyed a precocious education that was designed by his father and his father's friend, Jeremy Bentham. Mill was studying Greek at age 3, and by the age of 8, he had read all of Plato in the original. It's overwhelming, really. You think about that. He had read Plato in the original by the age of 8. In 1822, John Stuart Mill entered India House and quickly rose to be head of the office. You have to understand British ways there. To use the American equivalent, he became the undersecretary when he was just a young man. He wrote a great deal on logic, on economics, parliamentary reform, and women's rights. John Stuart Mill is politically correct. He was an extensive supporter of women's rights. He served briefly in Parliament from 1865 to 1868. One of the books he wrote was The Principles of Political Economy, published in 1848. The Principles of Political Economy. Another aspect of his life that may be about as fascinating as that he read Plato by the time he was eight is that Mill credited one Mrs. Harriet Taylor for his intellectual achievements. He was a longtime friend of Mrs. Taylor, and after her husband died, Mill married her in 1852. Watch your imaginations, just rein them in now. But the interesting thing is somebody of the stature of Mill is the 19th century supreme proponent of empiricism. He had great stature as an intellect, as a logician, as an administrator, a parliamentary reformer, and so forth, and he was willing to give this woman credit, he said, for his intellectual achievements. Interesting. I'm going to work backwards, in a sense, in showing you his philosophy. I'm going to talk first, real briefly, about his religious views, then about his epistemology, but then his utilitarianism, the reason why we brought him up today. First, on religion, he wrote in 1874 three essays on religion in which the very interesting, unique thesis is propounded that God is benevolent but limited in power. God is benevolent, but God is limited in power. And the reason for that is that if you look at the world round about you, you have evil. And if God were completely powerful, he'd be able to undo that evil. Or if you say that he's able to undo that evil and he doesn't do it, then he's not benevolent. He's sort of sadistic. And so Mill was willing to say, well, God, whatever God may be, he tended, I think, toward the view that humanity is God, but whatever God is a good being, benevolent, but not an all-powerful or sovereign being. Yes?
You said he wrote that in 1874?
Well, it was published in 1874.
Okay.
Sorry about that. If he wrote it after he was dead, we should really pay attention to what he was saying. Sorry about that. Unless I have it wrong in my notes, but I'm assuming that must be the date of publication. Now, as to his theory of knowledge, John Stuart Mill was empirical and inductive in his approach. Empirical and inductive in his approach. He was a supporter of Auguste Comte, C-O-M-T-E, indeed wrote a book entitled Auguste Comte and Positivism, 1865. He did not share Comte's view of social engineering. We're going to be looking at Comte pretty soon. He didn't share that. He was more of a libertarian in his approach. But he did share Comte's positivism, empiricism, and inductive reasoning. In fact, in Mill's, perhaps the book that made him famous originally, his System of Logic, a two-volume work in 1843, Mill looks at the limits of meaningful discourse. he's anticipating 20th century concerns here. He says, the only meaningful discourse is one where all the terms in it reduce to terms that deal with the sensible effect of properties. The sensible, by that tactile touch, you can, by observation and experience, note those effects. So he's quite empirical. He reduces everything that's meaningful down to the empirical posits. He held that all logic is reduced to inductive generalization. That is, Mill ultimately didn't believe the deductive principles of logic were in fact absolute and universal. They were inductive generalizations. And in the system of logic, he delineated four methods of experimental inquiry. Four methods of experimental inquiry, and laid out canons for determining causation. Those of you who have studied logic with me will understand immediately what I'm referring to. The rest of you say, what's this all about? Deductive reasoning has rules that we follow, and as I already told you, Mill thought they could be reduced to inductive. Inductive reasoning looks at experiences, gathers data, and when you're going to draw a causal conclusion that certain things cause other things, you need to have types of correlation that will prove that point inductively, not prove it with absolute certainty. But what are the what generally do we conclude is the cause of malaria? Well, we don't see causation of malaria, do we? It's not like you can watch it, and like a billiard ball, you know, around a table. This hits this and then ends up in the pocket. Here's where malaria comes from. We rather have all these kinds of experiences in the world, right? And so we have people who come in and they have experiences of these symptoms. And then you start finding out what's true of all these people besides those symptoms. And you have to check and cross-check and so forth. Like, what if people, forget malaria for a minute, what if you had a group of people scattered in various places in the country, and they all come up with this strange intestinal situation, this parasite that you can find that, you know, makes them, you know, vomit and lose weight and be dehydrated and almost die. And you want to know, well, what caused this parasite? How did this come about? Well, you do your research and you find out that it's that all these people, or not all of them, but the larger percentage of these people had all been in a particular city a particular weekend. Well, all of that's just data, right? You haven't got any causation yet. But what if you find out that people, that no one else is reported to have this except people who were in that city? And then you go further and you discover that these people who were in that city that weekend either stayed at or visited with people who stayed in a particular hotel. Okay, now I'm not giving a real sophisticated illustration, but what I'm getting at is, you see, you got to collect data, and inductive reasoning helps you to do these, you know, cross checks and comparisons, associations, and so forth. Then you finally get to the place where you say, well, it would appear that there was something maybe in the water or maybe out of the kitchen in this hotel that infected these people, and they talked to other people who were infected, and that's how we account for it. So now we know what caused it. That is the course of modern science. Well, Mill was the one in 1843 who tried to systematize the methods of experimental inquiry and develop what we call inductive logic. All right, so Mill is known for a rather unique view in religion. He's known for the development of inductive logic and the empirical criterion of meaningfulness in the use of our language. But he comes to our attention today primarily for his best-known essay entitled On Liberty, 1859. On Liberty. Now, I'm assuming that as educated people, all of you have read that. If you have not read that, I'm not assigning it, I'm not going to follow up on it, but That is one of the classic, you know, philosophical and literary productions of Anglo-American culture. Everyone should read Mill on Liberty, 1859. This essay is a defense of human rights, free speech, free association, those sorts of things, a defense of rights not by abstract principles, nature and nature's God. He doesn't appeal to anything abstract. He appeals to what? Utilitarian consequences. And according to Mill, we should be left free to do as we wish, quote, so long as what we do does not harm our fellow creatures. We should be left free to do what we wish as long as what we do does not harm our fellow creatures. And this he supported by an appeal to the benefits, the consequences that would come from that principle. Now you notice here that Mill is the very opposite of Hegel in ways which I'll expect you to explain to me later. The very opposite of Hegel. In the first place, there's no metaphysical jargon in this. That's why I'm able to lecture so freely. You don't have any problem understanding what he's saying. Hegel, we had to struggle with all of this jargon and these new concepts and so forth. Not Mill. Secondly, the whole orientation is different. Hegel asked about the true nature of the self's freedom. Okay, so Hegel's looking at the individual who is free, and he says, now, but what would be a more determinative and accurate notion of freedom? And through that, he develops the idea that the self is not autonomously free. Your true freedom is found where? In the state. So Hegel, if you will, is standing over against the unrestrained freedom of the individual and trying to show, no, you've got to have the state here if you're going to have genuine freedom. Mill, on the other hand, his orientation was quite the opposite. He wanted to know the justification and limits of the state restricting the individual's autonomy. Okay? So Hegel is looking at the individual and saying, don't think that's freedom. You've got to restrict the freedom of the individual by the state. Mill is looking at the state and saying, how do you justify the state restricting the individual's freedom? Their orientation is completely different. That's because their worldview and their presuppositions are completely different. For Hegel, the true individual, remember what I told you in lecture, is the state. What you call individuals, private citizens, are only organs. They are never the individual. They're organs of the individual. The state is the body. For Mill, the true individual is not the state, not the whole, but the private citizen. That's the way you're accustomed to thinking. So he's the very opposite of Hegel. I don't need to tell you a whole lot more about utilitarianism. You understand the theory. Do your moral arithmetic. Weigh the pains and pleasures. Do that which brings the greatest happiness to the greatest number. I don't need to explain it, but I am going to savagely criticize it. I have a lecture in our tape catalog some of you may want to get that illustrates this first criticism. When I went to Hillsdale College in Michigan, as you know, is the leading proponent of libertarian social theory and economics. One of the I was going in to present Christian worldview and challenge. One of the lectures I gave was a critique of libertarianism. And my argument was that libertarianism can be turned against itself. I said, if you follow the principle that you're free to do anything except harm other people, then you don't end up with the free market. You end up with the socialist intrusive state. Now, how could I do that? I mean, of course, the audience is just going, wait a minute, don't you understand what libertarianism? I certainly do. But if you have a secular principle of maximizing freedom as long as you don't hurt other people. Ask yourself, well, what hurts other people? Well, if I come into town and I open a hardware store in competition with you, and I do better than you, then I've hurt you, haven't I? And so that means the state should do a little bit of economic planning to make sure that everybody has a little bit of the business and not just those really, you know, savage competitors, these capitalists. And so what looks like a freedom philosophy can be turned against itself. And those of you who have studied apologetics with me, that's what is known as an internal critique, a transcendental critique. You take the person from where he is and use his own philosophy to refute him, to turn him into the opposite of what he thinks he is. Well, given the organic connections within society, and I use the word organic purposely here to sound a little Hegelian, given the fact that there are organic connections within society, just about any action is going to have an impact for harm on others. You know, we're so interlocked in our social relations that just about anything we do has an impact on other people, and often that impact can be interpreted broadly as harmful. Okay? I want to be free to leave Greenville at the end of this course and move on to Atlanta, present some lectures there. Hey, no problem. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not? What about the motel? If I move on to Atlanta, then they're going to have some, they have to have somebody else come in and take that room, or they're going to be losing money, aren't they? Now, there are other considerations that you might look at, but the fact of the matter is, every action, just about every action we take in society, has an effect on others, and it can be viewed as a negative effect. It doesn't look like I'm going out and getting a baseball bat and beating on people, harming them that way. That's what makes libertarianism look, you know, convincing. But harm, how do you define harm? Haven't I harmed you if I've taken away trade from you and so forth? Of course I have. Now you aren't going to be able to feed your family if you don't go out and work harder to get somebody to be in my motel room. And thus, a sincere and fully conscious application of the libertarian principle is likely to produce not fewer restrictions on liberty, but more restrictions on liberty. Look at the irony, the paradox there. A sincere application of the libertarian principle would produce more restrictions on liberty, not less. By sincere, I mean self-conscious, taking into account all the senses in which harm might be done to people. And so here you have the utilitarians refuted in that their individualism can actually lead to socialism on their own terms. Secondly, the utilitarians said that the legislator should do the moral arithmetic and tell us what the limits of our liberty are. But I have a question. Since Bentham held that all men are universal egoists, that's why he could be a utilitarian. He said, we compute the consequences because all men seek their own pleasure. And they avoid pain. That's true of all men. Well, if that's true of all men, isn't that true of the legislator too? He seeks his own pleasure. Well, if he seeks his own pleasure, then is he really being impartial and concerned with the general good? Or is he doing his calculation in a way that will make it come out to his benefit? What did we just learn from Kierkegaard and Nietzsche? There's something radically wrong inside here, right? Should we be trusting people that have some kind of radical off-centeredness in them, making our social decisions with this moral arithmetic? Neither Bentham or Mill took seriously the nature of the subject who was doing the legislation, which, just as an aside, you all know that I promote a Reconstructionist or theonomic approach to social decisions and legislation. That's why we look to God to make those decisions rather than human beings autonomously working them out on their own. We don't trust human beings to know what the limits of liberty are. Well, back to the lecture. Thirdly, utilitarianism can be criticized for its principle of maximizing pleasure. What does the word maximize mean here? You mean maximize the quantum of happiness or maximize the distribution of happiness? Utilitarianism can't answer that question on its own principles. Think about that. You know the difference between quantum and distribution, right? What if I were to have legislation that would bring just outrageously high levels of pleasure to everyone in this room, but would make everybody else in Greenville unhappy? But when you do the assessment, it turns out that you'd be so happy with my legislative plan that there would end up being more happiness in that scheme, even though some people are unhappy, more happiness quantity-wise, the quantum of pleasure, even though it was favorable to a real thin sliver of society, the students in my class. Is that what it means to maximize happiness? What's the greatest total pleasure points? Well, you know that isn't what most people think. They think that it's the greatest good for the greatest number, meaning it's got to be distributed pleasure. So that even if the total amount of pleasure points is lower, it'd be better to have legislation that gives a little bit of pleasure to everybody rather than a lot of pleasure to a few. Yeah, but how do you know that? Which maximization program are we talking about here? Distribution or quantum? Fourthly, when Bentham and Mill tell us to compare pleasures and pains, I have a problem with this comparison notion. As a matter of fact, pleasure and pain are incommensurable both intrapersonally and interpersonally. I'll explain my words, but that's just, isn't that nice that you can get these things boiled down to just a few words like that? That is, pleasure and pain are incommensurable intrapersonally, and interpersonally, inter. Intrapersonal, that is within the person, within myself, I'm saying pleasure and pain are incommensurable. How do I compare them? Now, you all know that I have certain medical conditions, and I'm not whining about that, but you've been made aware of that. I've had to talk about that. I don't particularly feel very good this morning. So should I be here on utilitarian principles giving this lecture? Well, on the other hand, as I think you can tell because I get animated in my lectures, I also love teaching. And I think philosophy has something to offer. And I also see it as a real great stepping stone for defending the faith and so forth. So I'm getting pleasure out of what I'm doing here, but it's hurting me too. Now, which is it? Do I get more pleasure than the pain that's being caused? Or is the pain greater than the pleasure that I'm getting from this lecture? Now, don't beg the question by saying, well, obviously the answer is you're getting more pleasure out of it because that's what you're doing, you're lecturing. No, the point is, how do you compare pain and pleasure within yourself? And how do you measure it so that you can compare it? It's kind of like, well, yeah, I've got 3 pain points this morning, but 10 pleasure points. And so, what on earth is that? Now, if it's hard enough to measure pain and pleasure intrapersonally, within myself, just think about the difficulty. How do I compare it interpersonally? My pleasures and pains over against your pleasures and pains. Because notice I talked about the pleasure of giving this lecture even though I'm not feeling real good. Well, how are you feeling as you sit there taking this lecture and your hands are cramping up because you're writing so much and your brains are about ready to burst because I'm saying all these big words and so forth? You may be hurting a great deal. And so maybe I shouldn't be giving this lecture. For all the pleasure it gives me, maybe it's giving you more pain. How do I know? Don't beg the question by saying, well, you know that we're getting enough pleasure out of this because we're sitting here, Dr. Poston. I mean, I'd give you an A if you said that, but I...
Go home, Doug.
Yeah, right. Get out of here. We got better things to do. We want to sleep in today, whatever. Now, we all know that life is full of these, you know, you have to make assessments and you get a net conclusion in terms of your decisions and all that. But how do you do this by way of comparison? How do I compare my pleasures to your pains? Okay, the Marquis de Sade got a great deal of pleasure out of torturing women. Now, there's no doubt that the women didn't enjoy that, unless they were masochists. Well, that raises a whole another complication now. What if there's people that enjoy pain? Okay, you know, it's like the masochist who said to the sadist, "Hurt me," and so he didn't. Because he was the saddest, he wasn't going to give pleasure to this person by pain. This gets really complicated. Marquis de Sade gets pleasure out of torturing women. Women, allegedly, don't enjoy that, but maybe his pleasure points are higher than their pain points. Now, I know you all have an opinion on that subject. I do, too. But by the way, mine comes from divine revelation. I couldn't possibly... I mean, I might fool myself, be deceiving of myself here. I couldn't possibly claim to rationally know that. How would you know that? Yes, I know that this woman's in pain. I know that this man is really reaching a level of ecstasy. How do I know what the comparison is between those two? So you see, utilitarianism is not just unworkable on its maximization notion. Its notion of comparing is unworkable, too. And I've got another criticism. The whole notion of future consequences. You should choose that action or that legislation that is going to bring, in the future, the greatest happiness to the greatest number. Well, what do you mean by future consequences? How wide are the consequences that we're supposed to consider? How wide, how relevant is the scope of what we're exploring? We tend to understand utilitarianism because we keep our mind on just one aspect. We say, okay, prison reform is going to have these consequences for prisoners, these consequences for guards, these consequences for judges, so forth. Well, what if prison reform means putting a new prison in my backyard? I don't know if you face this elsewhere in the country, but in California, we go through the throes of this all the time. We need more prisons badly, I mean, from the secular standpoint. We need more prisons, but no one wants prisons in their neighborhood. We've got people living in so many places. Where are you going to put these prisons? Well, so that may be something that the prison reform people didn't take into account. Did they take into account the economic consequences of having to buy the land to put the prison here, and no one else wants to come in for generations now and to build grocery stores near the prison? Well, they probably didn't. But now what you're thinking is, well, okay, we didn't think of that. We should. Okay, good. Well, but how far does it go? How many other consequences do we have to consider? Do we have to consider when, now that's going to stifle business activity in this area? And it's also going to stifle the building of public schools near the prison, and yet you need guards and wardens and so forth living there to man the prison. So now where are their kids going to be educated? And what are the effects of busing their kids to the schools that are further away? And what if those kids, because they are bused, don't get socialized properly? I'm following secular mentality here about schools. And they turn into juvenile delinquents and get on drugs, and then the drug culture is I'm going to stop here. You've gotten the point, right? Well, how wide of consequences are you supposed to consider? And how long, how extended are the consequences? Can any utilitarian... I mean, we've already shown that utilitarians can't make sense of maximizing, they can't make sense of comparing. But now, can any utilitarian calculate the consequences for 3 years' worth of prison reform? I'd say no, they can't. But even if they could they extend that to 5, 50, 500? Somebody says, oh, well, I mean, you don't have to do that. Why not? Aren't you being arbitrary? If you're going to look at consequences, at what point do you stop your consideration of consequences? This is a serious criticism. You told me consequences determine the rightness or wrongness of this. Well, what do you mean by consequences? Consequences 3 millennia from now? 3 years from now? 3 minutes from now? What are you referring to? There's another problem. And this one Mill tried to address. And that's the problem that not all pleasures seem to be equal. Mill's essay entitled Utilitarianism, published in 1863, tried to improve on Bentham's quantitative approach to pleasure. Bentham said, you just look at the quantity of pleasure, how much pleasure is given. Well, we've already seen, but we don't know whether that quantity is to be considered by distribution as well. But there's a bigger problem. Are all pleasures of the same sort? Are they all equal? Let's consider a pig and Socrates, as the old attack on this view would go. Mill himself dealt with this. Is a satisfied pig better than a dissatisfied Socrates, or vice versa? Well, English opinion in that day, and probably even in our own day, we may have some Nietzscheans who will philosophize with a hammer and say, go with the pig, by all means. We have a lot of piggish hedonists in our culture. But even in our culture, most people would say, better to be a Socrates in prison than a satisfied pig in the sty. Well, but on utilitarian principles, how can that be? Because maybe the pig has more satisfaction and pleasure than poor Socrates, who is hurting and is going to drink the hemlock. But he was a philosopher. And so we tend to think the pleasures of the mind are superior, morally better, than the pleasures of the body. And on this, you know, I'll sound like a walking commercial today. In our tape catalog, I have a lecture entitled, Can Utilitarianism Be Saved from the Swine Trough? Well, I guess you know my answer. I don't think it can be. Here's what John Stuart Mill did. He said, we have to take consideration of the quality of pleasure, not just the quantity of pleasure. And in so doing, John Stuart Mill, without even realizing, contradicted his own philosophy. Do you see that? Quality of pleasure as a consideration for a utilitarianist is a renunciation of utilitarian principles. What could it possibly mean to talk about the quality of pleasure? Well, if you hold to the hedonistic foundation of utilitarianism, quality of pleasure can only mean the more pleasurable pleasures, which makes it all the more piggish as a philosophy. But if you don't mean the most pleasurable of pleasures, then you must be introducing something beyond pleasure by which you evaluate the moral superiority of a Socrates to a pig. And so if pleasure and pain are the only factors in utilitarianism, Mill was actually contradicting utilitarianism when he introduced consideration of quality. Further criticism. Even if pleasure is the only thing men do desire in fact, it doesn't logically follow that pleasure is our only value. That is, it doesn't follow that men ought to pursue pleasure. The utilitarians committed what is called the naturalistic fallacy in ethics, that what is the case ought to be the case. So they would argue, the reason why we have to consider pleasure in our moral arithmetic is because all men seek pleasure. Well, yeah, but the underlying philosophical question is, ought all men to seek pleasure? That pleasure is a fact, or the seeking of pleasure is a fact, does not mean that it's a value. Maybe we should teach people not to seek pleasure. Maybe. Utilitarians just made a tremendous philosophical mistake at this point. And then there's a further difficulty. Why am I obligated to seek the maximization of happiness for the greatest number of people? Why am I obligated to seek the pleasure of society as a whole rather than just my own? That is, utilitarianism has as a competitor egoism that says I should make my decisions based on what makes me happy, not what other people are happy with. How can the utilitarians prove that even if we are to seek pleasure, see, they start by saying all men seek pleasure. I said, well, that doesn't mean that they ought to. But even if they ought to seek pleasure, it's another step to say they ought to seek the pleasures of others. Why should I be concerned with society as a whole? On utilitarian principles, I don't see how you could possibly defend that. You'd have to introduce another value, like the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Be altruistic, care for other people. Well, that's not a utilitarian principle in and of itself. So how is it justified? And I'll conclude then with, I mean, I've really hammered these people, but I need to because this is the spirit of our age, isn't it? I'll conclude with this criticism. The utilitarian belief in a simple empiricism as the ideal for all knowledge, the belief in a simple empiricism as the ideal for all knowledge, that is the plan to reorganize all aspects of life and put them on a rational basis, is naive. It is dangerous, and it creates nothing more but pseudoscience. Moral arithmetic, give me a break. In the nature of the case, morality, which is value-oriented, cannot be quantified into an arithmetic. But what I'm saying is this approach of the utilitarians is naive. I hope I've shown you that in my criticisms. It's dangerous, and it creates pseudoscience. Let me just look at the danger of it, and we'll move on. If I'm a utilitarian, let's imagine that as the head of the police force, I have a community that's been terrorized by a rapist, and we haven't been able to catch the rapist. Now, the rapist is not doing a lot of damage. Obviously, the women that get raped, we have to feel badly about that. But in terms of overall assessment, it's not like the rapist has 90% of the women who are being defiled. But there are some women who are being defiled. But now the defiling of a few women is creating in society what? A generalized panic, uneasiness. And that is creating difficulty among neighbors and relationship with the police and so forth. So now I'm a utilitarian. How do I approach this? Let me give you a legitimate utilitarian approach. Society is being hurt in the general sense. I'm not talking about the individual women who get raped, but society in general is being hurt by the fact that we don't have a suspect. And so what I will do is that I will find somebody who is not liked by anybody else in society, has no family, is a loner, has bad breath, can't keep a job. And we have individuals like that in our society. We have to do a little bit of research. Let's say we identify something like that. And what we do is we haul him in on trumped up charges and evidence. And now what we can put on the evening news is the rapist has been found. We're prosecuting him. Sleep well at night. Take it easy. You women, go back to the malls. Don't worry about it. Why not? Well, you say, well, Dr. Bonson, that's counterintuitive as to what we mean by justice. It's not right to accuse a man that's innocent. I say, right? What's right? The only thing that's right is what maximizes pleasure for everybody. Somebody say, oh yeah, well, what if this rapist rapes again? Well, then we'll tell people there's another rapist. And we'll do this again. We'll get another innocent person, and people will rest assured that they're all right. Now, it may be true that you can't do that over and over again. You could, you know, rewrite my story so that that becomes counterproductive to do it. But just in terms of the phase of the story that I've told you, utilitarians can't stand up and say, don't accuse an innocent man like that. If it would be for the good of society, the individual can be sacrificed. That's why I maintain that utilitarianism is dangerous. It not only leads to socialism, ultimately, but it also leads to the injustice of how you treat individuals in society. They can all be sacrificed for the public good. All right, that's all I have to say about the first secular school of thought in the 19th century. Do you want to ask any questions? I hope none of you find any credibility in this. I've taken a little more time than I usually do to criticize, because I really find this a deplorable philosophy, and it needs to be, I think, severely put down. Yes?
I've had to deal with libertarians myself in the past, and they reacted pretty bitterly against the things I said. If you were in Michigan dealing with libertarians there, how did they react to your achievement?
They were overwhelmed with shock that anybody would dare speak against libertarianism on the hallowed grounds of Hillsdale College. That's okay. Well, and they tried to, obviously, they tried to give considerations that would rescue utilitarianism from the, or libertarianism, pardon me, from the kinds of arguments that I have here, but I don't think anybody had anything adequate. What happens, and I'm now giving you a broader view of human nature and philosophy and debate, as a social reality, what and in this regard, you have to appreciate Nietzsche's insights. Philosophers tend to be hired guns. They're attorneys for a preconceived opinion. So when you have somebody come in who really rocks your philosophy and does it from within your own philosophy, now, maybe I didn't accomplish that. You listen to the lecture, decide for yourself. But if I did that, that doesn't mean people are going to stand up in the audience and say, I just want to confess my sins. I'm turning from libertarianism. You have convinced me. No, there's something wrong with human nature. There's, as if I can appeal now to Kierkegaard and Nietzsche in that regard, we're off-center. And we have this will to power. And so what happens is libertarians who have been refuted, what they do is they sneer at you. You know, they say, ah, what do you know? And they go back and they tell their students, this guy, you know, here's how we'd answer this, here's how we'd answer that. But all of it is just an expression of what? Their will to power. They're going to rationalize and try to hold on to what they have. Okay, we really have a lot more to get on to, so if you have questions quickly or observations, did I say hand? Go ahead, real quick.
Well, I was just going to say, point number nine, we used your analogy of getting us to imagine the thing that you told us. If you're utilitarian, can you say back to say that we shouldn't imagine that because it might not be pleasurable for all of us, and therefore we might not really want to listen to your speech?
I've lost you somehow.
In other words, you wanted us to sit and imagine
yes.
your whole setup.
Yes.
Town and the races and the trouble and have that set up. But if you're a utilitarian, can't you say, well, is it going to be flexible for the most amount of people?
Yeah, and the answer is it will, because people get pleasure out of holding to true theories rather than false ones. And so they will be happy in the end to have had utilitarianism refuted. You want to go another round with this? I mean, I can play this game, but you see what we're doing here? It's all a question of your presuppositions, isn't it? What orients you to what is pleasurable? You know, what kind of calculation do you do in moral assessments and so forth? Well, let's move on. In your outline for the course, I believe that the next entry is titled Materialism, Positivism, and Evolutionary Naturalism. Are we all on the same program? Materialism, Positivism, and Evolutionary Naturalism. The 19th century was a period where the hypothesis of God came to be viewed as unnecessary. Nature and science were thought to explain everything. The hypothesis of God came to be viewed as unnecessary. Nature and science could explain everything. And I want to look at a few individuals who represent that general character. First of all, Ludwig Feuerbach, F-E-U-E-R-B-A-C-H, Ludwig A. Feuerbach, 1804 to 1872. Feuerbach was born in Bavaria, studied in Heidelberg, Erlangen, and finally the University of Berlin under Hegel. Feuerbach was not appointed to a university chair, ended up giving public lectures supported by his wife's income. Feuerbach was influenced by Hegel, as I said. He studied under him, but he ended up writing in criticism of Hegel's idealism, and particularly in criticism of current Christian theology. Well, in the 19th century, there are a lot of people who criticize Christianity, so why am I picking Feuerbach? Well, because Feuerbach has a particularly well, in the end you can answer it, but Feuerbach's view has real influence. In fact, he influenced Marx and Engels in particular. But his view of religion is something you need to be familiar with as a thesis. He wrote a book, The Essence of Religion, in 1845, and then Lectures on the Essence of Religion in 1851. But his best-known work was The Essence of Christianity, 1841. The Essence of Christianity. Here's a historical aside. The translator of this German work was George Eliot. You know who George Eliot is? Please make me feel good. You know that George Eliot was not a George. George Eliot was Mary Ann Evans, who wrote under a male pseudonym. Mary Ann Evans also was the translator of Strauss's Life of Jesus in 1846. Two of the most devastating theological works of the 19th century, The Essence of Christianity and The Life of Jesus, Feuerbach and Strauss, translated into English parlance by the same person. Well, that's just the PS.